So I'm going to do a paper that's probably a bit more generalist for the Aussies in the room. I may be saying things, a lot of things you already know, but in colonial Australia of 1897, just before its federation in 1901, and with the country on the cusp of modernism, poet Christopher Brennan understumbled his way through a handwritten assemblage parody of Mallarmé's great innovative poem, Un Coup de Dé. Brennan's musical poem Adagraphoscope, written the very same year as Un Coup de Dé, is an immediate in-version, a version meaningful, which is significant, only to the cognoscenti, the in crowd, which in this case consisted of two people, Brennan and Dowell O'Reilly, Labour member for Parramatta, who was Brennan's closest friend and for many years the poem's only reader apart from Brennan himself. The poem is one of many sporadic refusals, to quote Kate Fagan, that the Australian poetic avant-garde has generated to escape, deviate or upend the acute anxiety that exists around the desire to define our national literary identity, an anxiety that might normally confirm our relation to the mother country and by extension our European heritage. But musical poem Adagraphoscope flipped that script. It was the first of a range of monstrous artistic objects that don't give a tinker's damn, that were born out of this tension of inheritance, and it established a particular alternative for Australian poetry at a key juncture in its history and development. While Brennan was otherwise introducing Australian poetry to the vagaries of French symbolism via more traditionally structured lyric poems, an influence that pervaded Australian poetry through much of the 20th century, musical poem Adagraphoscope, with its mocking vernacular or Aussie drag, Maison, Paris, Mallarmé, its freer use of counterpoint, to quote the poem quoting itself, and its embedded and furious criticality of conservative review culture, oh, that I grant you being existent, undeniable, irreducible, in all heaviness, immovable, without wings, a brick, was so back to front and obscure it became an invisible, unknown, subterranean alternative that lay dormant until its publication in facsimile, 1981, the year I was born. The poem is also a significant and distinct example of what I'd like to call inversion, of something that is genuinely antipodean in structure and conception, in other words, a poem or object that actively creates itself backwards or downside up, so to speak, by and through mistake. The word antipodean, from the Greek anti, opposed, and pous, foot, most often refers to being diametrically opposed, and literally means with the feet opposite. Geographically, it means on the other side of the earth. Australia and New Zealand have been referred to informally as the Antipodes since before their discovery by those in the Northern Hemisphere, whether from Britain, Europe or the United States, Antipodeans being anyone from or adoptive of that Atlantis-like region, nether region, down under. The fact that Australia is described colloquially as down under is a useful banality for those of us poets with our feet opposite, ferreting about in the arse end of the British Empire. When I say us, I vaguely mean us here today in the US, on the upside of the world, upping the ante, so to speak, doing our anti-antipodean thing, though antipodean at heart, as in anti, as in diametersexually opposed to anything the right way up, to allude to Jack Spicer's Unvert Manifesto and its philosophy of Mertz. By us and we, or Sue and you, I also mean those poets going back down under through Australian poetic history, inverts, unverts, sometimes not even poets at all, who always seem to get it back to front, upside down, the wrong way around. Those who, to steal a word from Lacan that I've already used, who in turn stole this word from an English slang dictionary, understumble who and where we are, those who understumble their way both away from and through our anxious desire for a national literary identity, channeling such Aussie traits as larrikinism and laconicism, but unsettling colonial heritage with aesthetic uncertainty, duality, multiplicity. I began with Christopher Brennan, but there were others before him who displayed traces of inversion in their writings, as seen in a number of poets who weren't known as poets. Consider the first recorded Indigenous person to write in English, Fenelong, whose letter to Mr. Phillips, Lord Sidney Stewart, in 1796 employs an excess of colons, and pleases that, as my fellow panelist Michael Farrell writes, literally colonizes the text and tends to a parody of punctuation and correctness. Printed with enjambments, printed with enjambments, there it goes. I have not my wife. Another black man took her away. We have had Murray doings. He speared me in the back, but I better now. His name is Caraway. That's only a portion of the letter. Now consider the bushranger Ned Kelly, who's dictated 8,000-word assemblage derivatory letter, a diatribe against the police who wanted his head, endangers English grammar in the Irish tradition of Joyce and Beckett. On an epic scale, its tangled syntax creates a meta-parody of unpatriotic rhythms that excoriate the poetics of the police, their simplistic imagery and prosaic functional language. Farrell writes, "It is ironic that the image of Kelly as writer is more disruptive than that of him as bushranger. It is such reversals, however, that are necessary to avoid the cliché of settled usages and to not take the ground of the past for granted, to not be easy." For an innovative elaboration of these two early Australian poets and many others, see Farrell's Rereading of Australian Poetics History, Writing Australian on Settlement. For now, it suits me to argue that these two poets understumble via a poetics of illiteracy upon what might be deemed an antipodean twist on that old chestnut negative capability, which we might remember is when a man is capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without any irritable reaching after fact and reason. Both letters are eminent parodies, to quote Kristeva, that unsettle and invert English colonial settler language and set the tone in Australian poetics for further antipodean refusals / monstrous inversions. And so, following the previously mentioned musico-poematographscope into the 20th century came a procession of monstrous artistic objects or projects. During the 1930s, Depression era, the Jindy Warabacks, a group of white male poets, touted themselves as the most important literary movement in Australia because of the challenge they laid down that the country should create its own distinctively Australian culture via a better understanding of the environment and through the integration of Indigenous subjects, language and mythology. Certainly something to aspire to. And they utilised this conceptual inversion to start a national conversation centred around poetry. But a disturbing jingoism can be heard in their desire to free Australian art from whatever alien influences trammel it. Their desire for a debunking of much nonsense, as opposed to wanting to grapple with and understumble the complexities of language, ambiguity and non-meaning, gives us a clue to their kind of backwardness. And by 1944, and with few women and zero Indigenous writers in their circle, they were creating anthologies with introductions that downplayed their initial ruptures and proffered a straight-thinking poetry with ties to our English cultural heritage. Perhaps they were simply backwoods poets whose aim to write pure verse was not at all perverse. Around World War II, two conservative poets, James Macaulay and his army buddy Harold Stewart, couldn't stand the modernist experimental works published by trailblazing young editor Max Harris in literary journal Angry Penguins. So they decided to wage war. Putting their boots on the other feet, they figured that if they collaborated to parody this new kind of poetry, they could overturn the turvy, topsy errors of modernist aesthetics. Mashing found lines together from various sources, they assembled nonsense poems under the guise of hoax poet Ern Malley and sent them to Max Harris for publication in an attempt to ensnare him in a sticky net of sarcasm, knowingness and humbug. The poems got published as they'd hoped, but in an inversion of Macaulay's and Stewart's cunning plan, all reversed in the quiet, reflecting waters, Ern Malley became a sensation, first as scandal, but then as genuine poet in his own right, simultaneously unreal and real. Ern Malley is now possibly the second most famous Australian poet internationally, lauded by those at home and abroad who can understumble his disjunctive collage poetry, this no man's language appropriate only to no man's land. In 1961, in the lingering post-World War II malaise, aesthetically and politically speaking, Gwen Harwood waged war against sexism by writing poems under nearly a dozen pseudonyms, all male bar one. She submitted two sonnets, Eloisa to Abelard and Abelard to Eloise, for publication under one of her male avatars to the Bulletin, so as to spite its stuffy male editors and to gain notoriety. The poems were printed But the editors didn't realise until too late that the sonnets were also acrostics, which spelled out, "So long, bulletin." And fuck all editors. She wanted to show them up because they were probably reading sideways, as usual. In the prevailing climate of primness, there was a furore, and on hearing that her naughty sonnets might garner legal attention the same way Lady Chatterley's Lover had on its recent publication in Australia, Harwood wrote, "It would be interesting to see the lawyers prove that the sonnets contained obscene material. I don't suppose British law provides for vertical readings of poetry." My favourite errant line in Harwood's poetry is from a poem with an inversion in its title, "The wine is drunk," and the line is, "I must be absent from myself," she writes, "and from a man's perspective," in that poem. On writing under her various masks, she once said, "I like disguises, I like wigs and beards." Speaking of masks, or flipped versions of the self, or the negative suggestion of self, or the apophasis of self, our most prominent poet, the self-confessed last of the Jindawarabacks, Les Murray, has always championed the underdog, not just in general but in himself, as if everyone were opposed to him. There is a kind of opposition in Australian poetry that has been described as internecine, where two aesthetic or political poetic extremes mutually destroy each other in full public view. Sometimes think of dogfights. Mutual destruction is the meaning of internecine, but I'd argue that these oppositions exist purely to perpetuate themselves rather than destroy, and in the process confirm certain individual monsters to a place in the hierarchy of Australian poetry, or to their place. I could lump Big Les into this essay on Antipodean logic for his translation of the Natural World poems, in which he manages to produce really protean poetry in spite of his self. But I'd rather include him for his opposition to anyone against his vernacular republic, such as latte-sipping experimentalists with frog in their throat, or American-influenced bête noir, and for this perturbed and perturbing ditty from his first individual collection of poems. "I shot an arrow in the air. It fell to earth in Taylor Square, transfixing to my vast delight a policeman and a sodomite." This was actually published. Perhaps Murray's publishers got it right when they gave him his elephant avatar. Even if it seems cutesy or friendly here, such a non-native animal symbol displaced into an Australian cultural context, whether it was meant to or not, alludes to the stomping power of British colonialism. Taming Africa and Asia was colonialism's game after all. Les Murray's herb is, of course, elephantine in volume now, taking up territory, colonising cathedrals, and often echoing the bush balladry of yore in its pursuit of a certain kind of Australianness, flogged and true blue, to quote John Forbes. Take an absolutely ordinary rainbow, whose opening recalls Banjo Patterson's The Man from Snowy River, a poem that Farrell has described as a non-parodic hero poem. And of being within the jurisdiction of police poetics, and that poem, sorry, there's that big quote. And that poem starts with, "There was movement at the station, for the word had passed around that the colt from Old Regret had got away." And so Murray's absolutely ordinary rainbow. This is just the first stanza, but they're repeated. "The word goes round Reapins. The murmur goes around Lorenzini's at Tattersall's. Men look up from sheets of numbers, and stock exchange scribblers forget the chalk in their hands, and men with bread in their pockets leave the Greek club. There's a fellow crying in Martin Place. They can't stop him." And each stanza, it returns to that fellow crying in some kind of astonishment moment. I also raise Big Les today so that I can pimp how John Forbes' poetry takes down various elephants in the room. In On the Beach, a bicentennial poem, published in 1988, as Australia celebrated its fictitious 200th birthday, Forbes opposes Les Murray's stained-glass-tinted view of the Australian ideal. That's John Forbes there, and this is part of the On the Beach. "Astonished trade union delegates, watch a man behead a chicken in Martin Place. Isn't there a poem about this in the shimmering ideal, or just walking down the street? Not being religious, we bet on how many circles the headless chook will complete. And won't this do for a formal model of Australia? Not too far-fetched, not too cute." Check out the laconic last line here and its deliberate enjambment, "model of Australia, not." And how Les Murray The poet becomes the subject in this poem, beheading a chicken, possibly, which itself could be standing in for the man crying, I don't know, in Martin Place, a famous street mall in the centre of Sydney's financial district. The above is from the second of six sections of On the Beach, a poem which is another instance in Australian poetry of a poet turning things on their head, or lopping heads in this case. In Forbes's diametric opposition to Les's national vision, and in poems despising the bardic and the mystic, to quote Gig Ryan, Forbes sees the everyman not as a vessel for reverence, but as a gambler, someone at the whim of chance. Eventually, On the Beach deliberately fizzes out when Forbes's model of Australia slides slowly at first down the beach and into the surf, that iconic to Australia liminal space where chance is intrinsic. In other words, our anxiety over the need to define, make a distinctive model of Australia will only lead to that model sinking feeling. Speaking of how to sink a ship, the next monstrous artistic object I could discuss is Chris Edwards's A Fluke, a mistranslation of Mallarmé's Un Coup d'Etat from 2006, particularly in the wake of Brennan's Inn version from over 100 years prior. But since I've written extensively elsewhere about how Edwards's homophonic translation of Mallarmé's Great Shipwreck gives it the finger, I'd like to flip the birds of a couple of other post-millennial mistranslations. Chris Edwards's... there's some flipping birds. And Chris Edwards's O Sonata Rilke renditions, which are new, and Astrid Lorange's Sunder Milk Good. Part larrikin, part love, subjective objects, objective subjects, and still biting the hands that feed them. Abject, genderqueer, and blankly ironic. Inside out, back to front, and hanging from the hill's hoist. These recent deconstructed translation sequences aren't new, as in never done before. See the Zukovskis. But they are antipodean and sometimes anti-colonial in the way they understumble their own anxieties and how they turn arse over tit, the language materials of influential and manipulative discourses into a resistant under-music of counterpoint and polyphony. Edwards's bricolage, his binding of subject and object, sees him break down the confessing lyric I, which according to Adorno has over the centuries produced the semblance of the self-evidence of poetic subjectivity. Edwards returns or inverts poetry back to the eye that speaks latently through the work, that of the other, the under, the sun-dried sundry. His inversions are literally extraordinary renditions where the lyric eye is taken to a third country, an underland, for interrogation. Here is the 19th of Rilke's Orpheus sonnets. And while it's sitting there in German, I might just read Edwards's English so you get a sense of how the play of words happens. When dolts and such like rush to rule the world, and we all wake up at workstations willingly enthralled to a wonky gestalt, one always volunteers to find fault with the automata. Uber dummies, Wendell and the gang, whiter and thus freer, wage nocturnal war against the verse-writing gang's blocked middle ear. Liar. Not since I denied it have I lied to you. I can't. Not since I first heard about this underland everyone's dying to be led to. Not since I emerged from it as Todd, capital T, of the infirmament, a shadow of he himself acting shiftily and weird. Anyway, leaden ziggurats may yet sprout over the land we've hollowed out and be feared. Another way to think of Edwards's treatment of Rilke is ucking up the farce. The only thing that survives of Rilke... So the only thing that survives of Rilke is his halitosis. A stink arose. Boom. That's the first line. In Sunder Milk Good, Astrid Lorange homophonically translates large parts of Dylan Thomas's Under Milkwood from English into Antipodean English prose poems, in which the feet of Thomas's poetry get crossed, become more stressed out. There are more syllables stressed, more syllable stresses, stressable sillies. By stressing the anxiety of poetic foot inheritance, stepping right into that tension herself, she relieves us of, and emancipates us in some way from, the British influence. For some poetic foot in mouth, here's the last chunk of dialogue from Under Milkwood. And you can sort of just kind of flick between them so you can get a few things. I won't read the whole lot. As you can see, there's a lot more stresses in there. Not only in this passage and others, Not only is this passage and others laced with queasy Aussie references, there's 80s band The Triffids, Daggy, John Farnham times 30, and the word wussy. It is also laced with feminist inversions. A green-leaved sermon on the innocence of men becomes a grey-livered semen on the inky sense often. And the chosen people of his kind becomes, and the chosen people of his grind. to conclude, each of these Antipodean poetic moments, these moments of having the feet opposite, is demonstrative of something iconic to and an iconoclastic within the progressive experiments of Australian poetry, inversion. But inversion in, not in the traditional literary sense, as reversal in grammatical technique, as in anastrophe, although it often involves this too. We may still be that country constantly reflecting on its own revolving, but we can invert the hemispheres in our imaginations so that our self-reflections make other and multiple revolutions. It's a structuring principle to be in opposition, and while I don't mean to conflate the concept of inversion entirely with being in opposition, I do want to reflect on how inversion in Australian poetry is reflected in and how it often takes its frippery from being Antipodean, literally. It's what I like to think of as a down-under conceit, a down-under negative capability, even as it sometimes comes with a heavy dose of negative culpability. The understumbling pun I nicked from Lacan, is its duality of stumbling and standing, speaks to the unsettlement and the paradoxical mobility at play when we play. At once naive about and knowing of the conditions of our anxiety, our desire, our identity, we know not to be easy, not to take the ground of the past for granted. We unconsciously understand that going from stumble to stumble, there's a progression. That's it.